1987 when I was in Carl Hartzell's office at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. I did one tape for the archives covering the period 1963 through the academic year ending in 1979. That tape, tape number one, covered broadly three subjects and focused mainly on academic processes in the Department of Economics starting in 1963 when I was acting chairman, and in the Federated Learning Communities, which developed in the 1970s, and also faculty development under an American Historical Association grant. The tape I am about to make is being made at the beginning of 1988, and I hope to complete it and send it to Carl Hartzell by the end of February or sometime in March. This tape, tape number two, is covering the area of administration as seen through my eyes in various administrative positions starting in 1965 and ending in the middle 70s. I leave out my administrative role as chair, acting chair of the Department of Economics from 1963 to 65, since I've already covered that in the earlier academic focus. In 1965, John S. Toll became president of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He arrived, if I'm not mistaken, than the beginning of the academic year, but probably in the summer. I had contact with him in the period when he was president-elect, and as a matter of fact, we had discussed Barbara Cashman's coming to the Economics Department as chair, so that at the end of the 1965 academic year, I was relinquishing my chairmanship as Barbara Cashman came on in September of 1965. Before Barbara Cashman's arrival, I was called in by President Toll, along with other administrators, to see if I would be willing to be either an assistant to a new graduate dean or an assistant to a new academic vice president who already had been selected, H. Bentley Glass, a renowned geneticist and, in a sense, a kind of international academic statesman. After serious consideration of the offer, I decided to become Bentley Glass's assistant. This was a challenge in several ways, since I had heard Bentley Glass. I knew about him from the AAAS and also from AAUP, in which organizations he had played a role of leadership. The thought of working closely with him was exciting to me, since I knew what his academic and political positions were, and he struck me as being a person of integrity and high value. The office of the academic vice president had just been established, and therefore it was being built from scratch, locating at first in the old library building. Old, of course, is silly because Stony Brook was very new, but old in the sense that it became the core of a larger, newer building. The area assigned to the academic vice president was close to where President Toll had set up his offices. Since Bentley Glass, while technically academic vice president, was finishing up a number of responsibilities and commitments that he had elsewhere, his presence during the first academic year was sporadic. I was charged, therefore, with setting up the office in a physical sense and also hiring some staff members, though he and I worked together in deciding which of the various candidates would be his secretary. Given the chore of setting up this office, the first 2 years were very busy ones, and there was considerable excitement in the sense of defining what had to be done and then trying to implement it. I stayed in that position from 1965 until 1967. The specific chores that were assigned to me came up as problems arose, but clearly I started out as a kind of office manager and also a handler of Dr. Glass's correspondence while he was away, especially. In addition, the various academic activities that reported to Dr. Glass would send their reports and make contact through me. This included not just the academic departments, but organized research, the library, and other related academic affairs. A major responsibility for the office in any university is academic and professional recruitment personnel policy in those areas. At Stony Brook, however, this was an overridingly important function since it was a new university and in 1965 had a relatively small faculty but plans to grow swiftly. The result was that the office, as well as most departments, were constantly in the process of recruitment, finding new people, sifting them out, and then eventually putting their appointments through the personnel policy process that we were evolving. In taking on the responsibility as first academic vice president of SUNY at Stony Brook, Dr. Glass had a clear mandate to develop in its various forms, schools, departments, divisions, a multiversity of the first quality. In order to achieve this, academic standards in various areas had to be set at a very high level. Certainly, Dr. Glass was the right kind of person to do that, since he came himself after having spent years at institutions of high quality and having committed himself to the search for excellence in all areas. He had, therefore, the ideal qualifications. In order to carry this out at the point of 1965, there were a lot of housekeeping details that had to be taken care of, but his main efforts were to be focused on recruiting a faculty and researchers of the highest quality. As the university expanded into an institution that would cover a wide range of activities, running all the way from a school of engineering to a major health sciences center. In all of this, Bentley Glass played a key role in terms of his contacts, in terms of the kind of leadership he could give, in terms of the attractiveness of himself as the leader, and in terms of the worldwide reputation that he had and the worldwide institutions and academies to which he had contributed or had been honored. Soon after his arrival, he reviewed with me personnel policy procedures and standards at Stony Brook. I was in a good position to help him at that time, since I was a member of the University Personnel Policy Committee, in effect a promotion and tenure committee, and remained a member over a period of 4 years from 1964 to 1968, being its chairman from 1966 to 1968. Dr. Glass was very much concerned that the personnel policy standards and procedures conformed wherever possible within the constitution of the SUNY system in conforming to AAUP standards. This is something that involved such things as notifying people of appointment, reappointment, non-appointment, and so forth and so on, as well as the whole question of tenure and other areas relating to personnel policy. With the very large and expanding numbers of faculty appointments, reappointments, non-appointments, and so forth, it was very important to set forth clearly, as soon as possible, the procedures that were to be followed. And this Dr. Glass did with dispatch and with a clear-cut understanding of the critical issues, an understanding from his long experience as an academic, but also from his commitment to AAUP standards. It is fair to say that he carried out this responsibility with great acumen, and that over the years there were relatively few incidents in which people could claim that their rights were not protected. There were a few occasions in which questions of academic freedom were raised. Dr. Glass always responded in those situations in a manner consistent with the values and standards of the AAUP. As a footnote, remember that he remained academic vice president through 1971. At that time, I think he was 65, and the SUNY regulations mandated that administrators end their tenure as such when they were 65. He then moved back full-time to the biology department. I worked closely with him from 1965 to 1967. I went back to my department 67 to 68. I returned as acting provost for the social and behavioral sciences, 68-69. I was on sabbatical, 69-70. I came back as assistant academic vice president under Dr. Glass in 1970. I stayed in that position in 1971 when the next academic vice president, Sidney Gelber, took office, remaining with him until 1974. The office of the academic vice president grew over time, its organizational structure, including more and more academic people. It grew along with other aspects of the administration at Stony Brook. For example, toward the end of the 1960s, when Stanley Ross, who was the Dean of Arts and Sciences, left, there was a reorganization in which a vice presidency was established, a vice president for liberal studies under the academic vice president and taking over the functions of the Dean of Arts and Sciences. The Dean of Engineering, of course, continued at that same level over the College of Engineering. In the office of the academic vice president itself, the various functions over which the vice president presided included such activities as all academic departments, organized research, organized activities, the library, personnel policies, and so forth and so on. In the beginning, when Dr. Glass took on these responsibilities and I was his assistant, the office was small. There were a few staff members, but it was relatively small. Over time, it grew. And at the point where, toward the very end of Dr. Glass's tenure in 1970-71, when assistant vice presidencies were set up, I was one of those, and there were at least two others. I can't remember the names of the people, but one was a black woman biologist who took over some of these functions, and there was at least one other person. The functions at that point, which I was responsible for, included the library and organized research, among other things. The other things included, as it had before, the handling of personnel, both faculty and professional, technical. The problems of a rapidly growing library whose holdings had to be enriched so that graduate programs that were being spun off would have adequate research bases. These growing problems were not only related to the size of the library, its holdings, but also to personnel. And there had been a succession of directors with not too much satisfaction. At some point in the period when I was in the office of the academic vice president, toward the end, we were confronted with the need to conduct a search for a new director and dean. And the search committee was an excellent committee set up with the intention of making a thorough search, conforming with affirmative action values and principles, and with the hope that we would recruit a first-rate person. It was a search that took considerable time, and we were pleased that in the end, we were able to appoint John Brewster Smith as dean and director. And I think, although I haven't been at Stony Brook for a long time, and not involved in its activities, I think that he has turned out to be a very good dean and director. One of the positive fallouts of his appointment and the process by which he was recruited was that affirmative action in the library was given a very strong boost. And as a matter of fact, one of the people who was considered for the directorship, a black woman librarian, later was appointed as Dean Smith's associate director, or some such relationship. And in addition, Dean Smith was very positive in his efforts to raise the level of recruitment of minorities. The result was that some of the intern programs and other programs had the fruit of uncovering and hiring first-rate minority people. In 1971, when Sidney Gelber became the academic vice president, the office was fairly well developed. In addition to the assistant vice presidents, there were several assistants to the vice president, so that there was a staff as well as secretarial help to give full-blown support to all of the activities that were essential to carry out the responsibilities of that important office. During the process of the office's development and administrative changes in other parts of the university, an effort was made in the late 60s, I think it was 1968 to be exact, to set up under the vice president of liberal studies provosts for the different divisions of the College of Arts and Sciences, let's say. And I played a small role in that, being appointed acting provost for the social and behavioral sciences. But there was opposition to this tier of administration in Albany, so that the efforts in that year, 68 and 69, to establish this structure were not successful. Ultimately, as we know, that structure was implemented, and what were first provosts have now been renamed deans. To summarize, during the 6 years of Bentley Glass's tenure as academic vice president, the office grew from nothing to a quite sizable group with its hands on all of the major academic activities. Bentley Glass himself was a very sincere and honest administrator who often knew that the president was making decisions that he, Bentley Glass, should be making. But for the most part, Bentley Glass never stepped over the jurisdictional lines of his office. He tried to maintain a very even-handed administrative role. He was very good in adhering to the values of academic freedom. In all of those 6 years, only once did I see evidence of his veering from that to some extent, under pressure from President Toll. And that incidentally involved me and the chairman of the economics department. It was in the late 60s, during the period of considerable student unrest. The department was taking action in some way to involve students in the departmental governance process. I say governance, I mean student presence on some committees. The president reacted very negatively to that, and Bentley Glass went along to some extent with the president, putting pressure on me as an economist administrator and the chairman of the department, Bob LaCashman, to reverse this action. I don't remember exactly how it was resolved, but I know that both Bob and I resisted very strongly. So aside from that, Bentley Glass, whenever there was an issue that in any way seemed to involve academic freedom, he came down hard on the side of academic freedom. And there are some other cases in my mind that I remember, one of a radical faculty member who was up for tenure and who was not in the good graces, naturally, of the president. And despite the president's indication of his inclination, Bentley Glass stuck to the principles of evaluation on the basis of performance and the usual canons that are employed in evaluating faculty who come up for tenure. Another aspect of Bentley Glass's administration was that he made decisions. He didn't shy away from making decisions. That's ordinarily is taken for granted, but since in the period after Bentley Glass retired from the vice presidency, the next academic vice president, Sidney Gelber, a very nice person, had a major problem in making decisions. That problem, of course, was complicated by the fact that the president was always trying to make decisions that were, strictly speaking, in the purview of the academic vice president. And while I don't know the complete extent to which Sidney resisted, if at all, those pressures, I do know that just in terms of making decisions, in Sidney Gelber's period, that is, while I was in the office, which means until 1974, from 71 to 1974, there were difficulties in his making decisions. Sometimes he gave the impression of having made a decision to those who wanted a decision, but in reality, oftentimes, that was not so. As a matter of fact, it took me some time to get to sense whether Sidney Gelber had made a decision and which way his decision was made. To put it facetiously, if I was sitting in with him when a chairman of a department or some other person in charge of an academic activity came in for support for a particular activity, financial and or moral support, I would determine which way the decision went by looking at Sidney Gelber's note-taking. If he jotted down a few notes and seemed to be saying yes, I would usually infer that he was really negative. In other words, the extent to which he took notes on the particular issue at hand was often an indicator as to whether it was going to be positive or negative. Now, obviously, this is an exaggeration, but it gets across the notion of the indecisiveness and the fact that people never knew for sure, never being a strong word, whether they had gotten the decision positive, negative, or maybe. In Sidney Gelber's tenure, there was another complicating factor, and that is that the position of vice president for liberal studies, which had been established in the late 60s after Stanley Ross left the deanship of arts and sciences, that position, while it was clearly under the academic vice president, was one in which the vice president for liberal studies, depending on his personality and inclination, could also make end runs, and often did. And there were two such vice presidents that I remember, Kalish being one, and the other one was, what's his name, from the philosophy department. They often made decisions to fill a vacuum or to pursue their own particular bent. A final word on the library. John B. Smith, who came as dean and director of the libraries probably in 1973, but in any event, a memo of April 3rd, 1974, which was shortly after he came, set forth a program for action on the library, which covered the public relations, the relationship between the library and the community, that is, personnel resources, collection resources, technical services, and public services. In this regard, we had at that point a plan for action for the library to expand quantitatively and also qualitatively to become at last a full-blown academic library for undergraduate and graduate activities. Whether that promise was fulfilled, and I suspect it was, I don't know myself, because I left the office in 1974, just as that program was being put into process. In addition to my regular duties under the academic vice president, I was also charged with chairing the Affirmative Action Committee. This was the committee made up of faculty members, which had the responsibility of implementing university policy on affirmative action, and that involved reviewing specific cases in which affirmative action was an issue. The purview of the committee extended not only to faculty members, but to all non-teaching professors. As the affirmative action program evolved, a university-wide, campus-wide structure also evolved. There was an overarching committee for the entire campus, and then there were committees under it, which were responsible for different aspects of personnel, recruitment and promotion and things of that sort. The committee which I chaired was the faculty and non-teaching professional group. There was one that covered administrative personnel and so forth and so on. Each one of the committees had representatives on the umbrella committee, so that there was communication that way, and there was also informal communication among the committees. Not only did the Affirmative Action Committee serve as an oversight committee, but it also had an educational function informally, and so that over time department chairpersons became more aware of the problems of affirmative action, the guidelines, and so forth and so on. The faculty committee had at least 10 to 15 members. I don't remember the exact number. And among them, we had a good representation from among women, some minority, and faculty members from different parts of the university. We also were fortunate to have some outstanding faculty members that lent greater respectability and solidity to the committee. We were pleased to have the Nobel laureate C.N. Young on the committee for at least a couple of years. An important contribution that the committee made was to provide departments with the different sources of qualified personnel, minorities, women, and so forth, so that they could take an active role in seeking out people from among these groups who would meet the regular qualifications for faculty and professional appointments. The routine reviewing of appointments was an important process because through it we got to know what the personnel policies of different departments were. We were able to sometimes put some pressure on the department to be more active in its search for minorities and women. And over time, a culture of affirmative action developed. The more controversial elements in our operation were not many, and they came later on in my tenure on that committee, when the committee was presented with complaints of discrimination, let's say. One in particular that I remember was a complaint that came from one department in which a female full professor who claimed to be underpaid in terms of her age and experience and professorial rank and publications and so forth and so on. This kind of involvement of the committee led to a conflict with some members of the administration, the president in particular, and ultimately there was a suit filed by this individual person, and beyond that there was a class action suit filed by women faculty members and joined by other women on campus, a suit that ultimately went to the federal district court, where the women lost. I personally was involved in that after I left Stony Brook, actually, when I was called on by the women and their attorneys to testify as to the operation of the Affirmative Action Committee and the policies that were set forth and how they were implemented. Paralleling my involvement in affirmative action was an involvement in some of the issues that arose during the 60s with student protests. One in particular was of some significance, and that was the whole area of minority students and black studies. And in the spring of 1968, I was approached by the academic vice president and the president. I should point out that if I didn't make this clear earlier, that I stayed working with the academic vice president through academic year 1967, and then I took a year back in my department. And so it was at the end of that year, when I was fully in my department, that Bentley Glass and John Toll asked me if I would take on some special assignment during the summer, and then starting in the fall become acting provost of the social and behavioral sciences. The special assignment had to do with the problems of student contention, student agitation, student demands for a variety of things, and among them was the black student demand for a black studies program. During the summer of 67, therefore, I had an important role in trying to come up with a solution to the problem, trying to help shape a program that would meet the academic standards that the university set for its programs. It was quite a summer because there were confrontations of all sorts, and we were able, I think, successfully to minimize the dislocations, to dissipate somewhat the anger and hostility and demanding nature of protests and of student pressure to come up with a program. It also meant dealing with people in the black community, in the larger black community off campus, as well as with various leaders and other members of the black community on campus, student leaders, black personnel in admissions and in other parts of the campus organization. Ultimately, of course, a black studies program. I think it received another name, Africana Studies or something like that. But in any event, the efforts of this period in 1967 were not without positive results later on. Another major area of my involvement in the period that I was at Stony Brook was in campus-wide activities. I was involved in a variety of campus-wide activities, either in my role as a faculty member or in my administrative role in the office of the academic vice president or whatever other offices I was involved in. Among these campus-wide activities was the Faculty Senate. I was at one point for at least a year or two, I don't remember the years, a faculty senator and participated in some of their activities. As a matter of fact, one of the things that happened while I was on the Faculty Senate was that the president, in the middle of the summer, abolished the Department of Education. This was without prior discussion, and ironically enough, even though the department generated that very important item, student FTEs, and that was a criterion that was almost always used as a bottom line concept, despite that, the department was abolished. That meant, incidentally, that people lost their jobs. Even people who had tenure, some of them did lose their jobs. The Faculty Senate was up in arms about that, and there were all kinds of efforts made to save some of the people, because we did have some excellent people in the education department, just as we had some who were not all that great. But that could be said about other departments too. I never subscribed to this knee-jerk anti-education departments on the grounds that they were qualitatively always very poor. We certainly needed some sort of academic umbrella, department, program to take care of the very large number of students, maybe mostly secondary school teachers in training, so to speak. At any rate, out of the erasing of the education department, there emerged a program in social sciences. And that was a program which combined certain of the education department functions in terms of certain teacher practice courses, certain, I've forgotten the name now, the methodology courses in particular disciplines. It also was an umbrella, this program, for East Asian studies and the Chinese language, which of course was a strange sort of combination, but that's where it fell. I was involved in the faculty committee that was set up as an oversight over the social science program. I also had a heavy interest in an East Asian studies program and in the Chinese language program, since those were areas of my research. There was another committee set up that also was a consequence of the end of the education department, and that was, I can't remember its exact name, but it was a kind of board set up to develop the standards for certification within the framework of our campus. And in that committee, there were people from, some who had been in the education department and still were on campus, others who came from different parts of the campus. In any event, here we were trying to improve as much as possible the quality of the offerings to meet state requirements in new ways and to assure that those students who graduated from Stony Brook in teacher methods in subject areas would be eminently well qualified. Early in my tenure at Stony Brook, I was